Welcome to the Insider's Guide to Finance, where we dive into stories from the front lines of financing public and private companies. I host seasoned CEOs, fund managers, bankers, brokers, and business experts who will answer your questions about how to properly engage investors, finance opportunities, and build outstanding success stories. We dig into the educational how-tos and mechanics of structuring good deals. You'll also hear about strokes of luck, tense negotiations, and the pressures of closing, as well as insights in how to navigate the capital markets. What you'll hear in these interviews may very well change the course of your career, your company, and your life. Welcome back to the Insider's Guide to Finance. In today's episode, we're speaking with Nick Cusick, who's the founder of Meadowbank Strategic Partners. His focus has been on investor relations and working with senior executives across the board of investor relations and engaging both shareholders and new investors. And so I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation. He and I have been developing a relationship and a friendship over the last couple of years, and I really like your approach to IR and the way you come at this. I find it very factual, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So the best place to start out is for an introduction from yourself, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, thanks, Corey. I appreciate the invite. You know, looking forward to the chat too. We'll have some fun. You know, a bit about me. I graduated from business school and went through a bunch of different areas in my career, did M&A, did BD, corp dev. I experienced or encountered IR back in 2005 for the first time. And just kind of always remembered it as I went through MBA and then back into kind of like the large cap corporate world. And it was my favorite thing. And an opportunity came up when I was at a company called Kiera, which is a infrastructure energy company, to get back into IR. And so I became IR manager there and got to learn from a very well-respected gentleman by the name of John Cobb, you know, kind of how to do IR from the large cap perspective, which complemented, you know, my smaller cap perspective of IR from the early, mid-aughts. You know, just one thing leads to another. I ended up, you know, co-founding a company outside of energy in the cannabis space and got to create an IR program from scratch there. That company is now Canada's largest cannabis retailer. So that turned out to be a good chapter and I kept my promises there. But I was very interested all the way along in just branching out and you know, having my own shop. So I created Meadowbank. It's been over 4 years now of doing IR for lots of different kinds of clients, different sizes and different spaces. So, you know, 20 clients and counting over that time and through, you know, various cycles of the market too, through the ups and the downs, you know, through COVID and now past it. So it's been a ride. It's been a trip. But that's, you know, just a very simple, you know, background story about me is I feel very lucky. I get to do my favorite thing and some other things around it. But I enjoy the intersection that IR is of the street, you know, of the capital markets and the C-suite. You know, I think that it's a rare space. It's a kind of a small world where, you know, somebody who's financially literate, who also has a flair for the written word can make their mark. And it's been a good run so far.
Nice. You know, even just in your introduction there, you said like, you know, part of a cannabis company there, co-founder of a cannabis company, and you kept your promises. And Nick, this is something that I've identified and seen within you is like there's a philosophy and approach to IR that it's not contrary, but it's definitely very, I think you come at it with a lot of integrity. And especially in ways when you're working with junior public companies, there can be a lot of BS promote. And I feel that you have none of that within you. You're just, you come at this as a way of honestly communicating story of potential and of, you know, sometimes hard times. Take me into your philosophy of IR and how that's worked for you.
Thanks, Corey. I appreciate that you see, you know, that quality in my work and how I run Meadowbank. And it basically just comes down to remembering one time I was a small retail investor emailing companies. And I remember the odd time where you would get a response, you know, as a teenager, undergrad, university student, and that sticks with people. And so when it's now my turn to be on the other side of that inbox, I make a point of responding to all the messages that I can, you know, when I'm responsible for a client's IR inbox, not just responding to the institutional investors that have, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 figures to invest, but also to the retail investor who is interested in the company, might be a shareholder, might thinking about becoming a shareholder. But I think that they're equal. And also, you never know. You never know if an institution is trying to get a sense of a company's culture or their integrity. You never know if a regulator or a commission is just checking up on things. And not that that ever really happens very often, but I just think it's a good measuring stick. It's a good rule. I think it's fair. And I think that treating people how you want to be treated is important in business. And not every public issuer works out. Not every venture company grows into a large cap. But if you treat your clients in that way and you treat their current and potential shareholders and stakeholders in that way and the other service providers that you're working with, then I think that carries through, it carries the day. And having a good sleep at night is important to me from an ethics and comfort perspective. You know, I want to get to the end of every day and know that I worked hard for my family. I worked hard for my clients. And like I said, can't win them all. You know, you're not a miracle worker, but if you hold up your end of the bargain and if you honor your contract, you do what you promised, then there should be no issues. And so, you know, that's where that comes from, Corey. And everyone's raised, you know, in different ways. What you choose to take into your career as far as your principles go is up to you. You know, I think every contract I get, every client that engages Meadowbank, that's a privilege. It's not a right. It can go away tomorrow. So, you know, that keeps you honest. You know, it keeps me in line. And I think it's important. There are no entitlements when you're, you know, in business for yourself. And so I'm comfortable with that approach. I think it makes sense to me. So far, so good. You know, there are lots of things out there that we can't control. We can't control if the markets are good or bad. We can't control if our clients are healthy or not, you know, prospering. We can't control if certain executives are easier or difficult to work with or certain shareholders are satisfied or not. But we can control our inputs. And, you know, if that word gets around, then that's an accurate portrayal of how I conduct myself and how I run Meadowbank and how I train, you know, my employee to conduct herself, then I think that's a worthwhile pursuit. And so, you know, I appreciate that you see that. You know, I think the same of you. There's a lot of competition out there. The barriers to entry for what we do, they can be seen as high because you need to know, you know, certain sets of rules and things like that. But at the same time, there's nothing stopping people from coming into the IR world and saying that they do IR. And so Your reputation does matter. Your network does matter. Referrals, they're 80%+ of where business comes from. So sure, you can make a quick buck if you really want to for a day, a week, or a month. But if you want to continue for years and, you know, pay your bills and have the luxury of operating, you know, your own business, then, you know, these are the things that I think matter.
Yeah. When you touched on the point about getting into culture and even institutions maybe just sussing out culture to see if IR responds, you know, I think about it a lot of IR to me and investor marketing are very similar to sales and marketing. It's relationships. You're developing relationships and you need to be known, the act of being known with your marketing. And so imagine somebody's going to come and invest in your company and they're going to do some due diligence and they're going to test out your sales cycle. They're going to come and see how fast do you respond to my inquiry about buying that product. And if they don't get a response back, what does that tell them about the company and the products they sell? It says they don't value the customer, the one who's feeding them. The same is exactly true for investor relations. So a simple response to an email can go so far. And I really think it's on point. There's this rippling factors of being able to see the value of investor relations if institutions and even retail are just seeing, do you actually care enough to do this? as a reflection of the culture of the organization?
Investors typically email when they're upset. And so when they're happy, they don't just email you to say, good job. You know, it's rare. Sometimes, you know, if an issuer is doing well and, you know, there's a prolonged trend of increased market cap, people will say, they'll ask questions and the tone will be friendly. But in a lot of the cases, when people are emailing, it's because they're not pleased or they don't understand something. It's easy to not respond or feel like you don't have to because that shareholder's position is minuscule, you know, compared to the rest of the cap table. But, you know, I disagree. I think that, you know, those people are deserving of a response. And oftentimes they just want a vent and they're not going to like find your address and come to your house and shake a fist at you. You know, they just want to be heard. And they, you know, if you address their questions or if you offer to have a chat with them on the phone, they most often just want to be heard. And your job is not to get them to, you know, be happy, you know, that like that's their decision. But if they feel like they've been heard, if they get to ask questions, you know, and if you're as transparent as you can be, you know, while respecting confidential and competitive limitations, then, you know, that typically satisfies, you know, the average investor. And whether they're a sophisticated research analyst or a portfolio manager or a retiree in, you know, rural Canada, who was just watching BNN and bought some shares or something like that, or surfing the internet and saw a banner ad. You know, I think that if you aim to get back to those people, number one, it's good practice. You know, you get to practice answering these questions more and more often. And, you know, that's always good. Everybody always needs the practice. You're never so good that you don't need to practice. Sorry, Allen Iverson, but practice is good. And number two, though, is yes, if that person feels heard, they're going to tell their partner or their friends, they're going to say, oh, this company got back to me. I'm not happy. I'm way down on my investment, but now I understand why it's down. Or now I understand what that news release really means, or, you know, why there was a change that potentially I didn't understand in the context of everything else that was going on. And so there is an aspect of education in IR that is very important. It's not just about mandatory disclosure and meeting minimum, you know, requirements to being a public issuer. You know, if you care, then I think that comes across. Obviously, more so over the phone, less so over email. But yeah, if you aim to get back to people within, you know, 24 or 48 hours, and the quality of your response is, you know, specific and tailored, then I think you're doing the right thing. Now, the secret on the IR side is that most investors ask similar questions. So you're usually answering the same question, especially around specific events. You know, the top five FAQs will usually be about the same. So to answer those questions, yeah, you might get 10, 20, 50 emails, but, you know, it's not as hard as it sounds to get back to everybody one by one. And, you know, there's some efficiency there. So, you know, and yes, I think that the IRO at Google or Shopify or Nvidia, you know, gets thousands of messages in a day, perhaps. Maybe that's true, or in a week. And maybe they don't have the horsepower to get back to everyone. But I also know that these days people are emailing less and less to companies. You know, they are looking more for information through search or social media or video. And so the inbounds I have found over time, you know, over working with 20 clients and counting, is that the inboxes are getting quieter, voicemail, like the phone lines are quieter. People are more self-sufficient, or maybe they people just are now being more conditioned, unfortunately, to feeling like they won't get a response. So they just don't bother, which is unfortunate. But I have found, you know, over the last 10 years, that, of course, it depends on the issuer, it depends if it's an IPO, a new story, or if it's something that, you know, has been in trading for, you know, an established period of time and the story is known. There's not a lot of, you know, catalyst. It's kind of like steady as she goes. You know, those inboxes are fairly quiet. Newer stories, yes, there's more inbounds, more curiosity, more intrigue, but or interest. So the commitment to get back to people, you know, every voicemail and every email, it really isn't that hard. You know, you just have to do it.
One thing I'm seeing, and I've kind of come to believe, is when it comes to investor communications, I like to draw the analogy of somebody buying a new car. So if an investor is coming to buy shares, imagine somebody's going to go to buy a car. And I always come back to the, you know, the parallel of selling a product or service to the consumer market. But the average car buyer today has more information about the vehicle they want than the salesperson representing the company selling the car. And that's, to me, is amazing. But that's the power of the internet and the power of somebody saying, I'm going to go put my hard-earned dollars into this vehicle or these shares. And to some degree, I think that it could be indicative of the way we now consume or the way we make purchases. And especially if you're a self-directed investor or even institutional investor, there's enough information online to start to solidify your own, you know, or firm up your own thesis of whether that's something worth your money or not.
There's a whole topic there. I mean, the level of due diligence that's available about public companies on Reddit forums, for example, is unbelievable. And so that's another reason why I think that inbounds are down, is because people can go to CEO.ca or Reddit or Yahoo and look into the bulletin boards and take a look at the comments or the homework that's been done by people and then make their investment decision based on that. Now, people who are consuming that information should know that some of those threads aren't genuine, and you know, you never know who has an angle. And you know, I think hedge funds don't have to disclose what they're up to. You know, there's lots of ways to manipulate information online, and that it is still the Wild West when it comes to that type, that style of communication. So people should take everything they read on the internet with a grain of salt, unless it's from the issuer itself, you know, from the horse's mouth. But yeah, you're right. Investors have so much information available to them now. Click of a button, they can get up to speed on investment opportunity faster than ever before. And now it's in more and more digestible formats. Everything is pretty much mobile friendly, and they can read it wherever they want, on their phone, on their tablet, or on their, you know, laptop, desktop. There's really no limit or no barrier to, you know, consuming however much information somebody wants or needs in order to decide on whether or not they're going to invest, you know, enter a position or exit. And so, you know, modern IR professional needs to understand the environment that investors are in and embrace it, frankly, but know where your information has to go, where it has to be put, beyond just crossing the newswire and putting it on the company website.
So I have a theory I want to test this with you. And that is that with the just like the rapid prevalence of AI and these large language models just be able to, you know, create content out of the blue, I'm starting to think and believe that in not very long, the only source of truth that people will be going to or will need to go to is going to be the website of the company itself to get every piece of information, because not because what's there is going to be, you know, fulfill all their needs, but because all of these chat forums, all of these other areas to find this information, the, you know, even MSNBCs, all these things are just going to be so inundated with noise, just GPT created noise, that it's going to be like, it's already overwhelming in my opinion. And so I'm seeing, and I believe that public companies, the only source for information is going to become that company's direct website. Everything else could be either made up, fake, or just more noise. What do you think about that?
It is the Wild West of AI right now. And certainly those risks exist. You know, that end game is possible. I hope not. But we will need to see what comes of regulation or control of AI. So the EU in December got together and said they were going to come up with an act, AI act, and that like the first draft of it was going to be ready sometime this spring, because, you know, AI, a lot of people agree that AI, including Elon Musk, agrees that AI needs to be controlled, or there needs to be some kind of fence, some limits to what we allow it to do, because frankly, like, it's artificial intelligence. We control it. You know, like, yes, NLPs, you know, they're models that learn. It's very, very powerful and amazing technology. But at the end of the day, you know, we still have control of these robots and these models. You know, we get to determine, you know, the extent to which they proliferate or allowed to proliferate. So for public companies, you know, there are, you know, in Canada or the US, if you're a public company, you have your own website. And then you have to put your information on a central repository of filings, so of like CEDAR in Canada or EDGAR in the States. And those are trusted places to get information about a company. But, you know, the filings are incredibly detailed, incredibly long, lots of fine print, not very user friendly. So, but they are trusted sources of information. The company's own and social media platform profiles. But, you know, yeah, like you said, those can be faked. You know, there are degrees away from, you know, the company's own website that introduce, you know, risk or the perception of maybe not being as authentic as it should be. So, you know, does that play into the hand of the IRO? TBD. I think it would be unfortunate if that's what happened, but I think AI is amazing. I haven't seen it steal my job yet. I think it's a tool that can help me provide services to my clients, but it's not as good. It's not as nimble. It's not as accurate yet as I am. It's faster at generating a mediocre first draft of a document than I am. But then there's an art that comes into it, of crafting the message, tailoring it, of applying best practices from the industry, or using the, you know, lingo of a client's certain sector, for example, to tailor that message and legitimize it or make it more appropriate to the issuer's investors and or stakeholders or you know, media base. So AI is good, but there's a way to go before, you know, I feel like it's a perfect substitute for me as a multi-decade experienced, you know, IR professional.
I'm certainly not putting out there that I think AI is going to replace IR professionals. I actually don't think it will, because a computer cannot replace human connection. And it reminds me of an interview we did with Jay Martin from Cambridge House. And we're talking about how every public company is going to need to become their own media company, their own communication company of putting out their own content and information. And so that kind of plays into my thinking, especially with the prevalence of AI, that all of the other channels in which you can go and find out about these companies are going to be inundated with so much noise that it'll be hard. And so you, if you're interested in a certain sector and you start to find companies, the place to go will be the company's website. So that's what I'm thinking. But talking about retail versus institutional investors, and I think this is always an interesting one. I'm sure you've experienced this with clients. Juniors are saying, well, we just need more institutional investors. And, you know, there's a part of, I'm not in investor relations, but there's a part of having, I think, to explain to them that you don't just go and, you know, pitch a non-liquid stock to institutions and they buy you. There's a thing you need to do to earn that, to work into it, to, you know, play to that level. And so that relies on retail. Now, where am I going with this question? I think it's, what's your take on retail versus institutions? And are there strategies to target each and actually build relationships with each to achieve goals?
I mean, obviously, it would be nice for every investor to have a giant checkbook and to take a significant position in your public company, because you met them once and, you know, you convinced them that you have a good business. That's unfortunately not how it works. But there are a lot of different types of each, and it's a wide spectrum. You know, an institutional investor could be small, could be large. Same with retail. Retail, you don't know if the retail investor you're talking to has $50 or $50 million. You know, there are things now called family offices. There are now, you know, quant shops. There are algorithmic trading. There's more types of investors out there now, aside from like the traditional PMs and, you know, retirees or individual investors, than there ever have been before.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's long onlys, there's hedge funds and the shorts. There's everything, like all kinds of different investors out there with many different angles. And so be careful what you wish for, because you might have a lot of institutional investors in your cap table, but they might be the wrong kind of institutions. They might be the hedge fund short selling type, or the, you know, algorithmic traders that don't care, or they don't pay attention to the effort you put into your messages. If they're algos or index funds or things that it's purely quantitative, then it just comes down to what's on your financial statements and your MD&A, period. Some algorithms now, well, many and more, I'm sure there's lots, we just, you know, don't know about them, but are starting to use AI or analyze, you know, the written word, which I think is interesting, very interesting. But that lends even more weight to the fact that the art of the written word can have a material impact on a company's, you know, trading multiple versus its peers, you know. And so, you know, that's why I think you have to treat and every inbound with respect, that that retail email could be, you know, somebody who's representing a family office, or they're just acting in a way that might lead you to believe they're insignificant and they just want to see how you respond. You know, it's not paranoid, but I just think it's a good standard. Whereas also, you know, when I was at Kiera, we had 16 research analysts covering the company. We had institutions from around the world that held our shares and did a lot, thousands of one-on-one meetings, tons of bank conferences, and still, like, for as sophisticated as they are, and they're all asking the same questions, you know, I could think of a very small number that really impressed me with how whip smart they were. And, you know, they happened to just, they represented big books of, you know, big, large amounts of assets under management. And they liked that particular story because it had a consistent dividend. So they were an income-driven type investor for that company. And so long as you kept satisfying that main thing, the dividend was maintained or increased, then life was good. And the underlying assets were relatively understood, then, you know, that satisfied them. But when I went to, you know, help, you know, start High Tide and created that IR program, that was almost all retail. And it was a completely different space. It was, you know, the green rush. People were, their expectations for their investment were not reasonable. Everybody thought all cannabis stocks were going to the moon and beyond. But still, you know, I endeavored to communicate with those prospective or current shareholders all in the same way and create engagement, create a relationship, create trust, or at least create comfort knowing that there was somebody on the other end of the inbox that was a human being that was a differentiator for us versus the peer group. And that's the race you're running as a public company. Otherwise, don't be public. You know, if you're a public company, you are, of course, concerned about the revenue line on your income statement. You're trying to sell some products or services to customers and generate gross margin and EBITDA and net income in normal course of business. But then when you are a public company, what you also need to understand as a CEO or C-suite is that investors need to, in a way, be treated in the same way as customers. Like, you are, it's not about making a sale. That's kind of a simplistic way of describing it. But if you don't understand that you have a duty just like you're putting effort into having people understand your products and services for revenue purposes, you also need to put resources into helping your stakeholders and shareholders understand your company in a similar way. And customers typically don't sell back the things they buy for more or less money than they paid for it. You know, that like being shareholder is unique in that perspective. And then you don't sell it back to the company either. You sell it to somebody else in the market. But still, you know, that opportunity, you have a duty to disclose when you're public, but the opportunity to communicate and increase or maintain a higher level of engagement and understanding amongst your shareholder base than your peers do in theirs. That's the other competitive aspect of being in business as a public company that is unique from being a private company. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating sometimes to come across companies that are public, but you're not sure why, because they don't engage with their shareholders and stakeholders any differently than if they were a private company.
Yeah.
You know, they do the bare minimum from a disclosure perspective. And, you know, they think that that checks the box and they're just, you're missing on a big chance.
Even private companies, from an investor relations standpoint, who don't communicate to their investors, I think is such a miss. And I'm sure you probably have written checks into private placements, private companies, and it's all great. You write the check, they take the sub, and then radio silence. And that's happened to me a few too many times to where I've now coined the term investor's remorse. And I like, terrible investor that I am, I don't give a shit if they lose the money if they give me a great experience. I want to be their champion. So just send me an email every once in a while saying that these things are good and these things are bad. And it's just
because your current investors are the best source of your next investor.
Yes.
Right? It's like your current customers are your best source of your next customers. It's the same thing.
Yes.
And so why make it harder on yourself? You know, just take care of those who you've already made the sale to in roundabout terms. You know, who people have written the check, who are holding shares, and help them understand where you're going. Be as transparent as is competitively reasonable. And yeah, help them tell your story.
Yes.
Keep them on side.
Help turn them into advocates, not shareholders. Yeah. I keep coming back to just the analogies of, or the parallels of selling a consumer product, whether it's, you know, B2B or B2C. But when it comes to investors, the cost of getting a new investor to buy versus the cost of getting an existing shareholder to buy, there's a huge delta there that I think both private and public companies need to keep in mind. But I want to come back to your discussion. You talked about 16 analysts in which you're helping manage at Kiera. And whether it's one analyst or 10 or 15 or whatever, talk to me about what developing relationships with analysts is like, because I think they're a very important piece of the puzzle that needs to be respected in the machine we call the capital markets.
Right. So if a public issuer is covered, or if coverage is being initiated by a research analyst, then the IR professional's duty is to make sure that analyst understands the business. They understand how money is made, how revenue is generated. They understand the costs of doing that business. They understand, you know, where growth is expected to come from. They understand the strategy. They understand, you know, what differentiates that story from others in its peer group. And, you know, you don't have to build their corporate model for them. They're good at that. That's why they have that job. But your job is to help them understand why the model for your company should be different than the model for, you know, its competitors, or where the opportunities are for value creation, or if they don't understand a certain product or service or department or strategic initiative, you know, it's your job to get them clearer on that so that they can model it properly. And a good model should translate into an appropriate target price or an appropriate investment recommendation. And analysts, they are trusted by investors for their math and for their recommendations. and you might not like their conclusion after initiating and, you know, onboarding them, but you have to respect their job. Just because you spend lots of time with them, or, you know, they like you, doesn't mean they're going to recommend people buy your stock. But if you feel like their model is accurate, and because they do understand your business, because you have invested the time in onboarding them and, you know, them properly, and them getting to spend enough time with management or in operations doing site visits or whatever, and then you've done your job. And then over time, you know, as they learn more and more about the company, you know, when there is an opportunity or when a catalyst has been achieved, you know, they'll factor that into their model properly, and then you'll get an appropriate adjustment to target price and investment recommendation. But the problem, though, now is that many banks used to have analysts cover a dozen companies, and now analysts are covering 25, 30, 35, 50 companies. So they're spread more and more thin per name, and their ability to dive deeply and, you know, be accurate or in depth in their research and their reporting is probably not as good as it used to be. And a lot of analysts who are being laid off are taking their skill set and going to issuers and going into IR. That's been a common trend. And sure, you know, they are good at modeling, and some of them also can write, but it's, I think, an oversimplification of IR to say that any analyst can become an IRO. I think that, you know, we could spend a bit of time talking about that if you want, but, like, yes, it's hard. It's a difficult job to get. Research analysts are intelligent people for sure. It's just now that they're spread so thin, their ability to prove that they can deeply understand a particular issue or really get deep into strategy or understand, you know, management is questionable. I think that because they have to cover so many names, well, how good are those models now? You know, because they get to spend 20 minutes per day on a name, or like when it's earnings season and all their covered companies are reporting in the same few days, they don't have a lot of time to ask questions on an earnings call. Or, like, you know, where I think the rubber hits the road is between earnings reports and how they spend their time and how many site visits they're doing. Are they even making, are they even allowed to make site visits because they're spread so thin? Can they dedicate a day or two or more to focusing on one company when they are covering so many others? I think the research community, research analytics is in an interesting spot. It's in a transition stage right now.
So can you talk to me about the importance of analysts in the machine and what it means to the issuer? And then maybe we can get into how, given the constraints that analysts are facing now, you know, covering once it's probably 10 times more, 5 times more names than they used to have to, what are some of the tips and tricks? So bring me back to, like, what is their function in the machine for an issuer in the capital markets machine? And then how, given the constraints today, can we start to engage?
Like, you want to be covered by a research analyst because their math, their report on your company is independent, you know, or it appears to be independent. If somebody's covered by bunch of analysts and your best target price and your best investment recommendation comes from the analyst that happens to work for the bank that leads all your financings, that's not a good look. That calls into question the integrity of their work. But of course,
the Chinese wall, which can't be called the Chinese wall anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's just an example, right? But in isolation, research analysts work, you know, it's independent math. And that's something that companies can point to. And you want that. You want to be able to point to something that's independent and say, you know, like, here, look, these guys think I'm worth $1 billion. And they'd say that you should buy my stock. It's not me saying you should buy my stock. This smart person at this big bank, you know, thinks that my company is a good investment. And so that helps, you know, make the sale, it helps attract new shareholders. And so you want that kind of independence. It's the same exact thing, you know, with words instead of numbers on the media side. You want earned media because it's independent. You didn't pay for it. It's a journalist out there saying good things about some part of your company that they just took an interest. They saw something interesting. They wrote about it and they put it out into the world. And it's independent. It's unbiased. It's not paid for. That's gold. That is the stuff that you hope for as an issuer, research coverage and terrific earned media because of its independence. And so that's why people want research coverage. That's the function of it. The function of it, you know, investors, portfolio managers, they don't have the time to screen every investment, every, you know, public company in the world. So they look to respected research analysts for their recommendations. They will like the style of the research analyst at TD or Scotia or RBC or CIBC, you know, whatever it is, and say, okay, yeah, that person tends to be right, or they cover a space in a level of detail that I can't do myself. So I will take their word for it. I will respect their math and their recommendations, and I'll allocate my capital, you know, with that factor included in my decision making. So that's the other reason why research analysts are important. But because they're being spread so thin now, their credibility is good, but the quality, like, you have to think, okay, these people are covering 2, 3, 4 times more companies than they used to. You know, it's a zero sum game as far as hours in the day goes. They can only allocate so much time per name throughout the year. So they know less per name than they used to. So I should take their recommendations with a bit more of a grain of salt because of that. That's just logical. That's rational. And so portfolio managers, then they need to either staff up to, you know, get more comfort around that, or, you know, do their own due diligence, or just themselves have better relationships with the issuers, you know, IRO or C-suite or both.
What about tools in IR? I'm curious because there's a lot of, you know, we've talked, or, you know, lots of names to go around. Irwin, Q4, BD Corporate. These kind of tools are another part of getting into the machine, getting known, developing relationships. What tools do you use or have you used, and how are you making them, you know, getting the best value out of these?
That's a good question. And, you know, the answer, unfortunately, is it depends. It depends on the issuer. Depends on their budget.
You sound like a lawyer and an economist when you say that. I know.
You know, it's the crappy business school answer. But, you know, it's just true, though.
Yeah.
Because what you should be doing per client is right-sizing, you know, the toolbox that they're using to fit with their budget or to fit with their stage of development, to fit with their market cap. And even though I would love to have a blank check for every client I work with and get to use, you know, all my favorite tools and service providers, like, that's never going to happen. You know, I had one client once where we had a sizable budget and we basically got to use the whole toolbox. And that was a lot of work, but it was fun because we got to check every box, you know, and shoot in every direction. It was, well, strategically, but, you know, we basically used every medium. And that was a good time. But that's the exception, not the rule. So which tools do I like? I have my favorites. You know, I've worked with, I don't know, I think my website says over 80, and I think that's still accurate. And obviously, and counting as new ones emerge. But the landscape changes, you know. And so a decade ago, there was no Irwin. There were just more expensive U.S. counterparts. And so, as that one example, when Irwin came along, that was a better substitute for what they did. And it continues to be a very good platform, a very good tool for people who are looking to track ownership, to target new potential investors, you know, to incorporate like a CRM type functionality into their IR work, and so on and so forth, to help with board reporting and this and that. And this is definitely not supposed to be an ad for that platform, but it's an example of how things have evolved over time in response to the needs of IROs and, you know, embracing technology to work, help you work smarter and not harder. obviously on the mailing list side, made big, nice mailing list platforms didn't really exist in the way that they do now a decade ago. And now it's pretty easy with, you know, pre-made templates and, you know, different platforms to execute, you know, drip campaigns and maintain higher levels of communication with, you know, people who are interested in and opt in to be kept up to date about an issuer and on and on. So my job at, you know, Meadowbank is to keep tabs on as much of this as I can and not just delete all the spam emails that come in, but to like look at them. Okay, what's this company offering? What's evolving on the landscape? How are these people saying that potentially they can use AI to things better or different or not? How much of this is a smokescreen? It's just garbage jargon to, you know, reskin the same old thing and everything in between. You know, how are people using forums? How are they using social media? TikTok was new and hot. Now it's one of the, you know, standard platforms. And, you know, what's going to be the next thing? Where like where investors are like schools of fish, you know, they tend to move to new places together. So your job is to, you know, you can't anticipate where they go, but you should keep track of where they're going when it's clear. And so they disperse too. People, there's now more and more places and you can't communicate with people selectively. That's, you know, a key tenet of being a public issuer. But, you know, if there are opportunities to speak to large groups of people in certain places, you have to know, you know, how to do that and how it's okay and what's not okay. And that all kind of rolls into being a good IR professional, is keeping tabs on the technologies that are out there that are making it easier to engage with large amounts of people efficiently, using things like video, that which is very, it resonates, you know, images, moving pictures, like graphics, infographics. Those are very powerful ways to have messages hit home, how to land hooks into readers and or viewers. I'm just preaching to the choir here because you're a good video guy. And so, you know, I think that will never go away. I know OpenAI just launched text-to-video beta, which has caused Tyler Perry to delay expanding his studios in Atlanta. You know, it's giving people cause, but like these tools can be used to enhance communications, period. And if you can get your message across at a higher level of understanding, then you're doing your job as an IRO. You know, your job is to help people understand what the company, what the issuer is doing. And there are best practices for doing that. There's lots of different mediums and medias, and that's the real trick. It is a corporate communications function. It's through a financial lens, but it is a communications exercise at the end of the day.
Something came to mind, and I don't want to be pumping our book of work too much, but when it comes to video, it's something that I think is going to become increasingly important when it's the actual individual speaking, not text to video. Anything AI touching video, I think, is going to start to become not rejected, but put to second class. And I'm going to give you an example of why this is. As you know, we had Zoom and we had Skype and all of these kind of video things before COVID, and nobody really embraced them. And then everybody did. And now it's the go-to way to who's going to go and sit down in a meeting in person. But I was at a client offsite, and there's three presentations by three engineers talking about the work we were doing. And two of those people were in person. One of them was remote and they zoomed in and presented to the group. One of the engineers got up in front of people and we ran out of time because we kept on asking questions. Another person got up in front of people, presented, and it was just like after it was radio silence. Same content. The difference being the person who was presenting in person captivated the room. And arguably what I'm saying here is that same parallel there comes to video as, okay, you're not the person in the room, but you're not AI. You're still an individual. You can communicate your expressions. You can use your body language that can be captured and scalably seen by thousands of people. If that is text to AI and it's got somebody who's an avatar of a CEO, I don't think that's going to fly.
It's early, and I agree, because even though you can tell the text to AI, like make it look like this is an interview or a speech you know, face to face, it's just not going to be genuine. And I think our brains are smart enough to be able to tell the difference. But also, depending on how the regulation works, you know, certain disclosures like are now required on social media when, you know, celebrities or influencers are promoting something, they have to say that they're being compensated for that message.
Yeah.
And so for AI, it is likely, or I would expect there to be some similar requirement where like a symbol or an asterisk or some disclaimer will have to appear to say that this was generated using artificial intelligence. Otherwise, deep fakes will cause a mess. And nobody wants to be the victim of that, you know, especially very wealthy people.
Yeah.
And typically that's who runs the world. And I don't think a lot of people disagree with that.
Man, we already hit an hour here. And so I'm going to have to wrap up our interview, but I got a couple more questions, but more on a personal nature. And you mentioned you've ridden the roller coaster or you know, it's been a wild ride in your business. What's been the most influential mistake you've made that you carry with you that you've been able to benefit from?
Gosh, you know, when times are good, it's important to remember that cycles are cycles. And that's like an absolute. A lot of averages will kick in. So when times are good, you should still do the things as if times are bad. You should still always plant seeds. You should still always do outreach. You should plant as many seeds as possible. You should continue to cultivate new opportunities and not rest on your laurels and not think that things will just keep coming. And because when the cycle does change, when it shifts to the next phase, when things contract or, you know, capital gets expensive and stops flowing temporarily, then you don't want to be without much leverage in your pursuit of future engagements. And so I'd say I've made like costly mistakes, but there's just certain lessons that stick with you where you're like, yes, okay, next time I will do a better job of X, Y, or Z. You know, like being fired stings more than losing a client. You know, like it just depends on how, you know, where you were in your career or when things happen and or how they happen and the mark they make. But it's what you do with those experiences going forward that shapes who you are over time and how your business evolves. And so, again, you can only control so much, can't control everything. But if you wake up every day, you roll up your sleeves, work hard, turn over every rock you can when you're looking for new things or when you do have engagements to make sure that, you know, you're exceeding expectations, you know, to the extent that you can control, then you should feel good about what you're bringing to the table. Mm. So that would be my answer to that question.
What about just final thoughts from, you know, experiencing the industry, considering our audience of entrepreneurs and CEOs and IR pros? Any final thoughts for them from our conversation?
I mean, the reward of being independent, of being lucky enough to work for ourselves, to be trusted by clients and engaged by them, I think that is true success. That's really what's worth the battle. You know, like some months are hard, some months are great. And, you know, all of those highs and lows, it's not for everybody. You know, I totally understand that. But if people out there have the personality or if they're interested in working independently or having their own business and they understand the difference between revenue and income and that's motivating for them, then it's, you know, even though sometimes can be challenging, even though mistakes can be made, even though markets can turn, I still wouldn't trade it. You know, it would take a lot for me to consider trading this in for going back in-house. I really would struggle with that dilemma because, you know, being able to do this with you, take an hour and a half out of my day and sit down and record a chat and bounce ideas off each other, travel, run into one another at conferences and events and try to build bridges and partnerships and leveraging each other's areas of expertise. You can't do that necessarily as an employee on somebody else's org chart. And so that's my main takeaway, is just that this is fun. You know, when we get to wake up every day and decide, you know, what we're going to do with our opportunity set, you have to have the network for it. You have to have the experience for it. But once you get to that point in your career, it's great fun to leverage it. It's fun to do your favorite things, you know, swing the bat and see how many hits you can get. And obviously always keeping in mind that like it's a privilege and that clients, you know, that's the boss and there's a job to be done. But, you know, I'm happy. This is a good time, regardless of the markets being challenging at the moment. I like being challenged to think about how to pivot my business or what I could do as an IR professional, as somebody with a corporate background to, you know, help clients and add value. And it's something that I'm having a good time doing.
You know what? I really like your point there about building bridges and the liberty to do so, and then how that could translate into value for clients and all that. That's really true. And so this is not a paid endorsement, but I definitely do support and vouch for you and the work you do with Meadowbank. So, man, really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks again for having me. And, you know, onward and upward.
That's it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Insider's Guide to Finance. If you enjoyed what you heard, please share this with your friends and colleagues so they can benefit as well. You can also subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or the Play Store. Your support there is really appreciated. For future episodes, if there's a question, topic, or specific person you'd like me to interview, feel free to reach out. You can connect with me on LinkedIn or through my website at creativereturn.ca.